The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
Hello, KKFI listeners, and welcome to Trans Talk, this week's edition of The 10th Voice. I'm Una Nowling, here with my wife and co-hostess, Fiona Nowling. And behind the board today is our sound engineer and producer, Linda Wilson. We have three guests with us today from Children's Mercy's Children's Mercy Gender Pathways Clinic, who provide a full suite of beneficial services to transgender children in the Kansas City area. Dr. Jill Jacobson, Chaplain Beth Sonneville, and social worker Kat Bowman will talk to us about all of the services that they provide, the challenges they face, and answer questions that have been submitted from parents, family, and allies of transgender children. Fiona will finish up the show with a community calendar update, but first, I'm going to take a look at some of the LGBT news of the week.
Like many aspects of transgender life and the transgender experience, transgender healthcare has advanced significantly in recent years, especially for children and teens. Last month, we talked with Dr. Meredith Gray from the University of Kansas Medical Center. This month, we are talking with three people from Children's Mercy Gender Pathways Clinic, who treat children right through to age 21 if they're under 18 when they start working with them. And they provide a full gamut of services from counseling to puberty blockers and hormones to social work and even a chaplain to work with you and your family. With us today, we have Dr. Jill Jacobson, an endocrinologist, Beth Sonneville, their chaplain, and Catherine or Kat Bowman, their social worker. Welcome to Trans Talk.
Thank you.
Could you introduce yourselves and the work that you do at Children's Mercy Gender Pathways Clinic in general to our listeners?
I'm Dr. Jill Jacobson, and I'm a pediatric endocrinologist, and we use a lot of hormone blockers in our pubertal transgender patients, and we use gender-affirming hormones as they get a little bit older.
I'm Kat Bowman. I'm the social worker, and my number one goal is to make sure that our patients and families feel supported. So I do that in a number. I try to do that, I guess, in a number of ways. And one of the first contact I have with families is usually over the phone with parents, where we kind of do a basic psychosocial, where I see where the family's at, and I can share that information with the rest of our team, and if they have any immediate needs, help families address that.
My name is Reverend Beth Sonneville, and I am a staff chaplain at Children's Mercy. And my primary responsibility is to be a spiritual support to the patients and families who come to Gender Pathway Services Clinic. And it's the same responsibility I have at Children's Mercy Hospital, because it's a place where all are welcome, all are supported in a manner that is appropriate to them and their family.
That's great. What are the specific endocrinology and other services you provide there?
Well, one of the recommendations by the consensus statement is to make sure we're not missing intersex conditions in our transgender patients. So we do perform physical exams in our patients. Of course, we don't perform parts of the physical exam that the patients are uncomfortable with. They're perfectly entitled to tell us when they're uncomfortable with certain parts of the exam. But we perform an initial evaluation, history and evaluation, and do some blood work. And of course, we work with the whole team to get the psychological input and spiritual input, and we generally come up with a group decision about who's ready for surgery, or not surgery, but who's ready for hormone blockers, who's ready for hormone therapy.
Thank you. And Dr. Jacobson, I know you were treating children there for quite a while just as an endocrinologist without the big support team. How did the Gender Pathways Clinic, the one-stop shop, come to be?
Well, there's been a lot of support at Children's Mercy to support this population of patients, and Dr. Daryl Lynch is the head of our adolescent medicine program, and he was personally very interested in getting the team established, and there was just a lot of general interest by multiple services. We have the head of our psychology group on our team is Christine Moser, and she had a personal interest in getting the team approach moving, and we've been doing it since 2014.
That's great. Now, Catherine, you mentioned that you like to support the family as much as possible. What sort of services do you provide for the family?
Yeah, I try to, if they have a specific need, help make sure they get connected to whatever resources there are available. People that live in Kansas City, there's quite a few resources here, more than people that live a little further out, I would say, at least that I'm aware of. But if they need parent support groups or family support groups or youth groups or even just a therapist in the community, I try to connect them. Things I also do is if they have primary care in the teen clinic at Children's Mercy, I can go down and we do like suicide screens there and things like that. And so it's kind of nice that I would be the social worker that gets to continue that relationship and meet with families down in teen clinic as well.
Thank you. And I'm afraid we have to take a very short break for a message now. So we'll be back shortly.
From the ballet to Broadway to Boys in the Sand and beyond, wading into Wakefield Pool's art, sex, and life. On This Way Out, Saturday at 2, right after the 10th Voice.
Jaws of Justice Radio investigates how we can achieve justice from a system of laws deeply rooted in economic, political, and social inequality. We strive to dispel misconceptions created by the news and entertainment industries, as well as the fear-mongering of the political system. Listen in as we search out the tools needed to make our community a more just environment. Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Welcome back to Trans Talk. And Catherine, I'd like to continue what we were saying about social work. Do you work with the schools as well to assist with the child's transition if it's needed?
If it's needed, yes, I am available to do that. One thing we like to talk through with our families is it's really important that you're able to advocate for yourself. I have gone to school before and met with some administrators and principals and counselors because that was kind of a time-sensitive sort of thing. And I knew that would be a big support to this family, and it was, the parent did a great job, probably did not need me there, really, but I did want to go and offer that support. But we try to give our patients the tools to go and represent themselves the way they want to and speak up for themselves and hopefully have a receptive school.
Thank you. Now, one thing I know a lot of parents are worried about nationally is family services, that they may think that transitioning their child is a form of abuse and that they may lose their child. Have you heard of anything like that or even rumors of anything like that in Kansas City?
I mean, I have not heard of anything. I'm sure if I say that's not happening, someone will say it is. So, you know, I don't want to say that's not happening. I have not heard of that in Kansas City. And actually, we have some places that are really trying to be very supportive and get education, like within our residential foster care. There's different places that, although not where they need to be, are trying to better educate themselves how to serve trans youth. And I think there's big room for improvement, but there are lots of allies that are case managers and our judges and guardian ad litem that are trying for at least some trans youth to have that support.
That's really good news, and it's good news to hear that people in foster care and the foster system can still get to see you into transition.
Yeah, there are barriers, I would say. If they have a transphobic case manager, it gets a lot harder. And we know that there's a disproportionate amount of trans people in residential foster care. And so, you know, why are they not being placed in homes? And why are they not staying there? I mean, it's a pretty big issue, but I do have hope that it will get better.
And moving on to more support with families, Beth, how do you work with the families?
Well, I started working with the team about a year ago, and I am basically called on to do what I do in the hospital, and that's just be part of the medical team in the clinic. I go see every patient and family who comes to the clinic, and I introduce myself as an additional support to them as they're going through this process in the gender clinic. And that's just part of the foundation of spiritual support at Children's Mercy, and it proliferates throughout all the disciplines in our hospital. Even though spiritual services takes a prime role, I'd like to say that Children's Mercy Hospital was named a 2017 leader in the LGBTQ healthcare equality by the Human Rights Campaign, and one of only 302 healthcare organizations nationwide to earn this designation. And I want to make certain that our patients and families are aware of how welcoming and affirming that we are from every aspect. And as a chaplain, I think that's my role, to be a leader when it comes to radical hospitality to all people who come to our agency.
That's really great news, and I know it's a really great resource to have available for our community. Do you ever work with people's churches to help them be more accepting?
Well, we have been invited to speak at a couple different churches, and, you know, it's kind of like the people who come to our clinic. It's those who are a bit more accepting. And so right now we're speaking to people who are already along that mindset of being affirming and accepting in their churches. I would be more than happy to go out to any church who invites me out to speak, as I think my teammates are as well, because I think it's important that we I grew up in a community where we talked about religious scripture and text as the good news. And I think that we as a clinic are professing that same good news in part of our health care for these children and their families. And I'd like that to continue on.
Thank you. And generally for all of you, transition is complicated and touches so many areas of life. How do you work with the child and the family to ensure that they all transition together and are ready to support each other?
So I often, in our multidisciplinary clinic, work very closely with our psychologists, and I'll be in the room. And so one thing we do is we sometimes kick the parents out, or we even kick the patient out of the room, because we know there are things that might need to be addressed in a very sensitive way, like talking to a kid. I notice your parents aren't using your pronouns all the time. What do you think about that? And it's a range of answers, right? Because they know their family, and we get a pretty honest response most of the time, I think. And sometimes that means we're going to kick the patient out and have some tough love for the parents. Like Beth said, we have accepting and supportive and usually pretty affirming parents in our clinic. They wouldn't get to us if they weren't, and we love and appreciate them. But there's, you know, still a range of what's going on. And so we do sometimes, you know, have to talk to parents about it might be unintentional, but it matters. And I can't remember what your question is. I hope I'm still answering it.
How do you make sure that they're all ready to transition together? Because the family has to transition with the child, or they can't move forward.
Oh, yeah. I was kind of answering that, I think.
Yes, I think you are.
You know, another thing is, like, siblings, that can be very difficult. And so talking to parents about strategies, and, you know, we don't have all the answers. We see into people's families for 2 hours sometimes, and that's all we get to see. But we have some knowledge, and we hope it works for families and try to help by giving that.
How do patients get to see you? Do they need to be referred by a counselor or a doctor, or can they and their families approach you directly?
Oh, okay. So to actually be seen in clinic and see an endocrinologist, there are two things that have to kind of be taken care of first. We do make sure that all of our patients have a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. And so that's really to make sure we're seeing the correct people in clinic. We don't want our endocrinologists to be seeing people that don't have dysphoria, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we do have that. And then the other thing is an intake call with me. Now, there's not a particular order that has to go. Sometimes I get calls from families and they've just found out their kid has just disclosed their gender identity to them and they need a therapist. How can they, you know, move forward with that? So I try to give them resources of people in the community. Or if they're in a place where they cannot get to a therapist, they can come to Children's Mercy, and I can send in a referral for Dr. Mosier, or we're about to have a clinical social worker that will also assess and get a diagnosis that way. We really want to help you get to clinic.
That's great to know. And perhaps you mentioned a little bit about the intake process, but could you describe the intake process and a first appointment for us, please?
Yeah, I can do that. So the intake process is, you know, one, we do get a lot of referrals from doctors, pediatricians, therapists, or someone can call. We have a website out there. And you speak with a person who schedules the intake call with me. So it's like little steps, baby steps to get there. Usually by the time this person calls you, you can talk to me within a week. I try to keep my calendar pretty open because some families are in a very good place when I talk to them, and other families are having a little bit of distress. So I try to be as available as possible. That call takes 20 to 40 minutes usually. I've had one be 10 minutes and another one be an hour and a half. It depends on the family and how talkative the parent is usually. And from there, once you've had the call with me and the diagnosis, then you get to see an endocrinologist typically first before the multidisciplinary clinic.
So what would the first appointment be like then with you, Dr. Jefferson?
Well, we would spend typically about an hour talking with the family and the child. We do a physical exam. We do some blood tests. A small percentage of transgender patients will have chromosomal variations, so we will sometimes do chromosomal studies. And we talk to the families about, you know, kind of lay out all the options, what options are available. A lot of times, the puberty blockers have been, well, they've been very helpful in this population because they're considered a reversible treatment. We could start puberty blockers, and sometimes we use them even as just a mechanism to buy a little time to get to make sure the family is kind of on the same page. They've been around for decades. They're very safe. We've used them for decades in girls and boys with precocious puberty. So, and pediatric endocrinologists are very comfortable with that hormonal treatment. We always start to address issues like fertility and for our transgender patients too, and that's part of the guidelines. We also, there's some safety concerns that we pay attention to. Hormonal treatment can sometimes be associated with an increased risk for blood clots. It turns out that's not as common as it used to be, and most of the clots occurred in when they were using an older form of estrogen treatment, which is not used anymore. But if there's we do make sure there's no family history of blood clots, and if there is, there's some additional blood blood work will do, and just basically go over, just give them some choices and talk to them about the process. There's often some insurance issues involved. A lot of times we've generally had very good luck getting the insurance. Certainly the insurance usually pays for the lab testing and the office visits, and most of the time we have very good luck getting the medicines paid for as well.
And one thing I like to tell families on the phone call is, okay, you're not there that you want to have medical intervention for your kid yet. You're scared of regrets. You're scared of, you know, is your child going to hate you if you make one decision or another? Coming to clinic to see an endocrinologist is not consent for treatment, right? You're still the parent. You get to make that decision. But what a great opportunity to come to Children's Mercy, talk to an expert. I mean, our endocrinologists are experts, right? They know all about this. Come and ask all your questions. There's great information on the internet, but there's also bad information on the internet. So come talk to the doctor about your concerns.
I think that's a very good point, because I've had a lot of parents say, I'm not ready for this yet. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'll ever be ready for this. Mm-hmm. And how do I know that I will get the right diagnosis? I've known my child all their life, and this person sees them for an hour or 10 minutes, and how can they be sure?
Right. Well, and the new guidelines are no longer going to require people to get a diagnosis made by a mental health professional. The new guidelines are going to require the diagnosis be made by somebody with experience in that condition. So things are constantly evolving.
And, you know, right now we work with teenagers and kids, and they're under 18. But parents, wouldn't you like to come in? Because once your child turns 18, they're going to be making their own medical decisions. Wouldn't it still be nice to have talked to a doctor and know about what they might decide to do on their own? You know, that's just the reality, is that we want our transgender kids to grow up to be transgender adults.
Right. And we're not, and our goal is we don't push anybody in a certain way. We don't pressure anybody to follow a certain pathway, but where our main goal is to be there to support people in their decisions.
Thank you. We have to take a short break for some music, and then we'll be back with our team from the Gender Pathways Clinic.
Hello, and welcome back to Trans Talk. We're here with our guests from the Children's Mercy Gender Pathways Clinic. That's twice I've mispronounced that. The song you just heard was I'm a Boy by The Who, which some feel is sort of emblematic of the experience of being a transgender boy. Probably not, since it was written, I think, in 1966, but there you go.
And getting back to our guests, I'd like to ask, what's the sort of lead time before a new patient gets seen?
That is something we are trying to improve. We don't see people quick enough. That's just the reality. But we're doing our best. And by the time we receive a referral and you get a contact call to set up my talk, we'll probably have a phone conversation within a week of that contact. And then you see an endocrinologist usually
within a month.
A month, yeah, I'd agree with that. And then how long for the multidisciplinary clinic?
There's probably a 3 or 4 month wait to get into the multidisciplinary clinic, but you'll be seeing team members individually before then.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if you all are kind of victims of your own success in the great work that you've been doing to help the community.
No one wants to answer that comment.
No, thank you.
Is there any way of shortening that lead time if someone's in an emergency, and what would actually classify as an emergency?
The biggest emergencies seem to be more psychological emergencies, and those we really try to partner with our community psychologists for that, and we keep lists of trans-friendly psychologists and mental health support in the community, and try to give that information out to the families when they're in crisis.
Yeah, I have kind of a fear that if it turns into a, oh, my child is cutting, my child is trying to hurt themselves, they're not safe, and you get into clinic faster that way, it's kind of an incentive for very desperate people to harm themselves when they may be on the edge of that already. And to me, as a social worker, it does not make sense for someone that is unsafe to meet with an endocrinologist. That's just the reality. To address safety, I should say. If you're really that unsafe, family members need to call 911 or therapist or whatever crisis number.
That makes a lot of sense. Do you think that you mentioned something, Dr. Jacobson, about something that might count as a crisis if someone is right on the edge of puberty and about to have irreversible changes?
Right. We do try to prioritize people who maybe are just about to have a voice change. We definitely don't want such a long wait that their voice changes while they're waiting for a clinic appointment, because our puberty blockers can definitely help them with that. We also have patients who get very depressed around the menstrual cycle, so that would be another red flag. And we do know that we do generally see that anxiety and depression can be much alleviated when the child starts transitioning toward the desired gender. So we know that they feel better once they start the transition, we need them to be working with psychologists at the same time.
And our concern as well is that's our whole population. I mean, not necessarily right on the onset of puberty, but that's a lot of our population. And so it's hard to say to one family, yes, you're going to get in right away, and other families, you're going to be bumped down a little bit because another kid is distressed during menstruation. So,
and we do have some people who aren't as distressed with menstruation. We
Absolutely.
Have more and more people who don't have so much dysphoria. As society becomes more accepting of trans, we're seeing more and more families who really aren't in terrible crises.
I agree completely. Mm.
I'd like to ask Chaplain Beth a question that many parents and family members of transgender children, as well as the transgender children themselves, have asked, which is, especially ones that come from religious backgrounds, why is this happening to me? Why would God do something like this to me? And I assume you probably have heard similar things yourself. And what would you tell a family asking this?
Well, I typically begin by talking about how important it is that religion and medicine are in dialogue. I think that religion without medicine, there can be superstition, judgment, shaming, shunning, and killing. I think medicine without religion means there's life without meaning and purpose. And I think that what I know about creation is that there is an exorbitant amount of diversity. And there's diversity that sometimes we don't like to acknowledge. And I think people of faith, and I've seen this with bathroom debates, that people are saying, men should use men's restrooms and women should use women's restrooms. There's other statements that God made us who we are gender-wise, and we can choose to be who we want, but it doesn't change who God made them. And so there is this understanding that religion is really central to this debate about bathrooms and transgender. But I think what is helpful for religious people is to actually look at scientific data. There's this belief that females are XX chromosomes and males are XY. But when we actually look at the data from the World Health Organizations, we find that 1 in 3,000 life births, female births, has a X chromosome only, a single chromosome. There are 1 in 600 live male births where there is an XXY chromosome. 1 in 1,000 live female births are triple X chromosomes. And then 1 in 1,000 live births, male births, are XYY. What I find most interesting also is the statistic that says 1 in 300 to 2,000 is an intersex child, which there's no distinguishing whether the child is male or female. And the reason that the statistic says 1 in 300 to 2,000 is because there's no scientific definition globally of the term intersex. So they really can't pin down whether it's 1 in 300 births or 1 in 2,000 births. And so if we actually pair up the scientific data with a theological understanding, people, humans, are very diverse when it comes to our DNA, to gender, to who we are in our own identity. I think all the three major religions believe that God created in their own image, male and female, which gives us an understanding that the divine image is both male and female in the same being. But I think we get confused as people of faith thinking that it's all about the tangible body. But when we look in Scripture, we talk about spiritual gifts. And those gifts include a message of wisdom, not the whole totality of wisdom, but a message of wisdom. The second is a message of knowledge, not all knowledge, but a message. Some people have the spiritual gift of faith, others the gift of healing. There's miraculous powers, there's prophecy. There's distinguishing between spirits, there's speaking in tongues, interpretation of tongues. So the things that are really important theologically are the things of the Spirit. And I think the Jewish Jesus came and taught that our differences are physical difference, our gender differences, our ethnic differences are really irrelevant. And that Jesus went out and met all persons, wherever they were, and received and accept each of them, where and as they are. And I think that's why the Christian then disciple talked about in Galatians that there is no longer Jew or Greek. There is no longer slave or free. There is no longer male and female, for all of you are one in the body of Christ. So I'm not certain that there are mistakes. People are people. And it's our culture that distinguishes and oppresses and makes differences important. And I think diversity is very important in this world.
All I have to say is, wow.
Well, we said earlier that I did something unusual. I reached out to family members in the community and ask them for any questions they'd like to ask now or would have really liked to have asked while they were waiting for their first appointment. And so I'm going to move on to those questions now. And one of them is, if people call and keep getting voicemail, is there an alternate way to get in touch with you, like an email address perhaps? Or?
Well, I would first like to say we are now aware of this problem, and we are going to make sure that the voicemail is not full. Our phone number is 816-960-4134. And if that is what you have been calling, Monday morning I will be at work and I will be trying to address this, okay? We apologize.
Thank you. And how can parents know for sure that they're getting an objective opinion or diagnosis? When your focus is helping transgender people and gender non-binary people, they worry that if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Sometimes the diagnosis seems remarkably quick, and they've known the person all their life. They really want to be sure.
Yeah. I personally, myself, do not diagnose. However, I see where parents are coming from. That's a concern. The thing we have to remember is a trans person might just be sharing something with you that they've been exploring internally for a long time. And so what our therapists in the community do and what our psychologists do and our clinical social worker does, they listen. They take time to listen and, you know, and rule out other possible things as well. But listening is just a big key component to that.
One question that gets asked a lot by parents and two other parents is one adult people don't usually have to deal with. How do you know it's not a phase? And what if it is a phase, how should you help and support your child during it and afterwards?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things we do, we're not, like I said earlier, we're not pushing people to one direction or another. We're basically there to support them in their own feelings and their own plans. And there was at one time a concern that a certain percentage of people would desist, would change their minds. It used to be thought that about half of people would change their minds, and this would happen in puberty. It turns out that it's a very tiny percentage of people who change their minds. We have, out of our 250 patients, we've had only two patients who've changed their minds about being transgender. So it's extremely rare. And we also, we're there to provide support while the family is sorting things out. And we can use these hormone blockers while they're sorting things out, and there's no harm done. There are no irreversible consequences of using these hormone blockers.
And one thing I did want to say as well, I'm sitting here as a cisgender person, and I can say those numbers and things that, oh, there's a very low desist rate and everything. But one thing I really like to provide our parents is we have a program at Children's Mercy called the POPS program, and we have these wonderful volunteers that are parents of transgender kids and can address that. Hey, my kid's grown up, still transgender, you know, and really provide a different support that anyone else on our team, like, we're just not equipped to provide that perspective. And so I know a lot of our patients and parents have formed really great connections. And thank you. If any volunteers are listening, we love and appreciate you.
And POP stands for Parents Offering Parent Support.
Part of my discussion with theological issues is helping people know additionally the science behind transgender children and youth. Child behavioral specialists tell us by the age of 3, an individual has an understanding of their own gender. And the research has shared also that the critical age of understanding and persisting in an awareness of gender other than what the physical body demonstrates is age 10 through 13. So a lot of the understanding is if we can use pubertal blockers to get a child to that age of 10 to 13, they're able to verbalize very readily who they are and express their identity. But even I think younger people and parents are watching their young children play. Children may not have vocabulary, but children express themselves through play and dress. And I think when you truly ask parents, what have you been observing about your child? They can tell you. They can tell you. And so I think it's just, I think the fear for a lot of parents is they don't want their child to be different. They don't want them to stick out. They want them to fit in. And I think we do that. We help people fit in by expanding our acceptance of differences in society.
I think the driver behind that not wanting to stick out is that they're afraid that they will be bullied, that they'll be picked on, maybe even worse, and that they won't be able to have that happy life that they dreamed that their kid would grow up
to
have.
That's right.
What about people with other conditions too? For instance, if they're also ADHD or bipolar, how do you manage multiple conditions and make sure that the medications for one aren't interfering with the meds for others or even the source of some of the symptoms?
Well, fortunately, well, as an endocrinologist, I like to say that all of our treatments are natural substances. We there are actually very few interactions with the hormone, with the puberty blockers or the gender-affirming hormones with their other medications. And generally, they'll continue on with their other medications and with very few side effects or interactions.
And I, obviously, as a social worker, do nothing with medication. However, if I have questions about how another diagnosis might be impacting a person, Children's Mercy is, has a great social work team, and so I call the social worker in the ADHD clinic and say, you know, I really need some education. Can you help me with this? Just like other social workers call me and they say, we have a transgender person coming to care in another clinic. We want to make sure we're affirming what's the best practices, and we really try to support each other and make sure that everyone has a good experience.
What about if someone's already finished puberty and they're very developed? Should they start on Lupron, or are there other options? And if it is too late for Lupron, are there options so that at least trans males don't have to deal with having a period?
I think nationwide, a lot of people use those puberty blockers in younger children. We sometimes will use them in a little bit older children if we're trying to optimize growth. We'll sometimes use puberty blockers to stop the menstrual cycle if it's extremely distressing. And we'll sometimes use puberty blockers if we're having a hard time getting any effects of estrogen, because estrogen and testosterone are kind of battling each other. So there is a lot of flexibility to use those medications at different ages. And there are alternatives to the puberty blockers, too. There's a medication called spironolactone that will block testosterone receptors, and that we use that as well.
That's good, because I know Lupron is horribly expensive and often difficult to get the insurance companies to cover it. What are the long-term side effects of testosterone?
Testosterone, it turns out that at one time there was a big concern that testosterone would increase the risk for uterine cancer, and the most recent studies are showing that it's actually safer than people thought, and the lining of the uterus actually becomes it kind of shrinks down, and the recent studies show there's no increased risk for uterine cancer even with long-term exposure of testosterone. So they're not necessarily recommending hysterectomies in patients who are exposed to testosterone for long periods of time, although anytime you have the body part, we do need to continue with screening for cancer of whatever organ is still in place.
And what are the long-term side effects of testosterone? Estrogen, I meant to say.
I think the biggest fear was the risk for blood clots, which now we know it was only related to the old ethinyl estradiol. So the risk for blood clots seems to be lower than thought in the past. There are fears about increased risk for breast cancer. So anybody who is on estrogen for breast development needs to have regular mammograms to monitor for risk factors for that. The recent studies are just showing that the hormones are safer than previously thought.
And we're getting long time, so I'm going to ask one last question, which is that will my child have a chance at healthy relationships after this? Could they have children?
Fertility is a big issue in our transgender population, and we actually Children's Mercy created a job description for a nurse navigator to help our patients with fertility issues, and there's a nurse navigator helping us with fertility questions in patients with chromosomal issues and in cancer patients as well. But we also work closely with reproductive endocrinologists over at KU, and have referred several male to female patients to KU for harvests for sperm banking prior to starting estrogen therapy.
And I've got a question. Someone said that their child has a diagnosis and has come out to them as transgender, but they're not in a huge hurry to be living as them and to transition at school. Is that normal? Is that something they should worry about? Are they really transgender?
The fear is they don't want to transition at school?
Yes.
I mean, I don't think that's something to be worried about necessarily. It's a scary thing, disclosing your gender identity. And you have some fears I think are natural about friendships and acceptance. And, you know, we want people to be in the place where they accept themselves and aren't fearful of acceptance of others. But I hope that person eventually is accepted by their school.
We see quite a few people who don't want to transition until they can completely transition. And one saying I like is, if you've met one transgender person, you've met one transgender person.
Yep. But I've also heard a lot of youth say, I just want to pass. And mm-hmm. So I think the importance is, like Dr. Jacobson said, is to, when you're fully ready. And I wonder if it would be helpful for some children maybe to transition during a summer or something, where they can do that and then start school feeling like they're going to pass.
Yeah. And another one is, my daughter says they're gender neutral but still wants to transition to a boy. Why would they want to change genders if they're gender neutral?
We have several patients in that category. And it's, you know, like I say, it's just, the wishes are just very variable. And some, we have a patient who wants to transition to male, but you know, doesn't want the hair growth. And so it's, you know, we just listen to the patients and try to find out what features do they want, what is it that they're interested in, and try to provide support for whatever they want to accomplish.
Yeah, and gender is so personal. Just because your child is not interpreting the words gender neutral the way you would, doesn't mean it's wrong.
And I'd also like to suggest that maybe some of the things that children and youth are expressing are not just indicative of youth. But I think as adults, there is a lot of body dysphoria. And I think there's an understanding that people have for themselves of what it means to be male, what it means to be female, what it means to be attractive. And I think with all the plastic surgery that goes on in this country, a lot of different medical interventions on behalf of adults, there's just this human need to have our body image to be something different than what it is.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of questions we didn't have time to ask today, so we would love to have you back today sometime, and thank you for coming on. Mm-hmm.